The past year proves that a lot of conventional economic wisdom is neither true nor wise. For example, we don't have the money. The power elites tell us it would be nice to do the big-ticket reforms America needs, but the money just isn't there. Then, a pandemic slammed into America, and suddenly trillions of dollars gushed out of Washington for everything from subsidizing meat packers to developing vaccines, revealing that the money is there. We can't increase the federal debt. Yet, Trump and the Republican Congress didn't hesitate to shove the national debt through the roof in 2017 to let a few corporations and billionaires pocket a trillion-dollar tax giveaway. So, if those drunken spenders can use federal borrowing to make the likes of Amazon and Zuckerberg richer, we can borrow funds for such productive national needs as infrastructure investment and quality education for all. The rich are the makers who contribute the most to society. This silly myth quickly melted right in front of us as soon as Senor Coronavirus arrived, making plain that the most valuable people are nurses, grocery clerks, teachers, postal employees, and millions of other mostly low-wage people. So let's capitalize on the moment to demand policies that reward these grassroots makers instead of Wall Street's billionaire takers. Tax cuts drive economic growth for all. They always claim that freeing corporations from the burden of taxes will encourage CEOs to invest in worker productivity, and voila, wages will miraculously rise. This scam has never worked for anyone but the scammers, and it's now obvious to the great majority of workers that the way to increase wages, hello, is to increase wages. This is Jim Hightower saying, percolate up, economics works. Trickle down does not. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So tomorrow is the big day in California. The moneyed interests have really pushed hard to throw Governor Newsom out, because they understand, look, if something happens to Dianne Feinstein, you want someone crazy like Larry Elder to be in the governor's mansion to put someone even crazier into the U.S. Senate and also to swing the balance of power. That's the goal behind this. Now, they're using the fake outrage and the outrage that they've created over the mask mandates and over, you know, just the simple fact of wanting people to protect themselves and others. So this is what we're going to see tomorrow. And I'm going to be interested to see what happens in California. Like always, it's going to be, you know, how many people show up, how many people voted. But it's going to be interesting to me to see how many people vote no on this recall and hopefully send a message. I'm here to share some thoughts on what maybe we can expect, what's been going on the ground in California, and where this may all take us. I've asked our good friend Joe Sandberg to come talk with us. Joe's progressive business leader, investor, also the head guy over at Asperia Bank. I highly suggest. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So your take on where this is gotten us on this whole recall thing.
Well, I think we have in California to thank Governor, I call him Death DeSantis in Florida, for the reason that this recall is going to lose. You know, a month ago, the polls were looking pretty bad for Governor Newsom, but over the past month, I think that the governor smartly made this campaign about how Larry Elder, who would be the Republican to take over likely if the recall were to pass, would turn the state into Florida as far as COVID. And let's just look at the stats really quickly. Last week in Florida, tragically, 2,500 people died of COVID. Last week in California, tragically, 38 people died of COVID. Not any single death is one death too many, but I think that lays stark contrast what's become the centerpiece of this campaign, and that is, do you want a COVID response like California, or do you want a COVID response like Florida? And Larry Elder really insolently ran on turning California into Florida, and I think that what Governor DeSantis has done in Florida has hurt the recall campaign in California.
Yeah, and good. I think we need it. Not that I know much about what Governor Newsom has done. I think, like many governors, presented with bad options and worse options. And I believe he's taken the least worst options possible to help protect people. And I don't hold anything against someone who, if they make a mistake and they err on the side of caution, I don't hold that against them. Someone like DeSantis, I can't not think that this guy's literally killed people.
It's because he has. Look at the California and Florida statistics and two cases in point. 38 COVID deaths in 1 week in California, 2,500 in 1 week in Florida. That doesn't account for the fact that Florida is one half the size of California in population. So on a per capita basis, it's even worse than Florida.
Yeah. So what's the sentiment on the ground right now? I know some of the polling, as you said, has turned around. Some of the people that I've talked to have said that they're guardedly optimistic that the recall will be put down. What's your sense?
You know, I think a month ago it was really looking touch and go. But I think what happened in the month since is that a lot of voters who were either unenthusiastic or on the fence became understandably scared that if the recall were to pass, then California would become like Florida as far as the COVID situation. And Californians understandably don't want that. You know, I think about this myself. You know, I have my mother, with whom I'm very close, is in her mid-70s, and I take some peace of mind knowing that we have the COVID situation, relatively speaking, in much better control here in California than we do in Florida. I personally wouldn't feel safe in Florida as regards to COVID, and I think the statistics bear that out.
Yeah, or in any of the southern states right now. I mean, I don't know if you saw that story out of Alabama where, you know, a guy, I guess, that was having a heart attack. They called 43 different hospitals in three states to try and find him a cardiac ICU bed, and they could get nothing, and the guy ended up dying.
Well, Rick, it's really important that you amplify that, because it's not just about COVID death. It's about how all of these COVID extreme cases that are occupying hospital beds then crowd out the availability of hospital beds for people who are having heart attacks,
right,
stroke, or non-COVID medical emergencies.
No, I've said from the beginning, Joe, that the reality is, you know, it may not be deadly at high numbers, but if you overtax the healthcare system, then everything else becomes that much more magnified, and we can't slam our healthcare system. And you look at Mississippi, where they're turning parking garages into field hospitals. You look at Idaho, where they're allowing the rationing of some care. You know, this stuff is going to happen as you overtax a system that isn't used to having this kind of volume.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So in answer to your question, I think that the recall is going to fail, and I think it's going to fail by a pretty comfortable margin. Now, that doesn't mean that California is satisfied with our state. We're not. But we've been presented in this recall with a choice between science and science fiction, and fortunately, science is going to win.
Yeah, and hopefully you don't get Larry Elder. I mean, you know, I was talking with somebody the other day, and I go, there's a sadistic side of me that would go, you know, maybe a Governor Elder for a couple of months would be fun. And then I go, no, people would die because of it. And there's no fun in that.
You're absolutely right. The COVID situation makes politics truly a matter of life or death.
And again, it magnifies that elections have consequences. And we'll find out tomorrow in California how this plays out. Now, for me, the other part of this is, again, we've got an election coming up next year. And a pretty big one. And this is another one of those examples where I say elections have consequences. We've got an infrastructure bill that I fear we don't get pushed through. We've got a lot of things that need to get done that, because of, you know, a handful of senators or representatives, we might not get through. For me, this is that moment where we better figure out how to get some more reasonable people into our political system, especially on the Republican side. I'm hoping there's a movement to take that party back somewhere near sane, because right now, nowhere near the sane line.
I wouldn't hold your breath for that to happen anytime soon, unfortunately. And I think that we also need to be careful not to become too optimistic for what happens tomorrow in California. The recall is going to be defeated tomorrow because the recall campaign has become centered around an extreme right-wing crazy lunatic named Larry Elder. In 2022, though, people are going to be going to the ballot and voting on matters of economics, on what we've done to make the country better for working people. And the Biden administration and a Democratic Congress have to deliver on a lot of promises they made in 2020 that are still open. And we shouldn't read more into what happens tomorrow other than that Californians are going to vote to not become Florida on COVID.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And look, I'm guardedly optimistic for tomorrow, but I look at someone as extreme as Larry Elder is. And one of the things I saw the other day that just made me kind of stop in my tracks is here's a guy who said, we better not talk about reparations because we're going to have to give the white landowners money back who lost their slaves. And I'm going, I don't know how you can say that.
Well, Larry Elder's white supremacist, fascist.
But he's a black guy.
Doesn't mean he can't be a person possessing of white supremacist, fascist views.
So I'm hoping California has some sane moments and puts this down. And then moving forward, we've got to get some movement on the infrastructure bill. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. As someone who is a progressive business leader, as someone who's built businesses, as someone who understands this, to me, the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, the human infrastructure bill, is just as important as the $1.2 trillion hard infrastructure bill. It was something we've needed for decades, and I think would create more jobs, would create prosperity for everybody. But yet we've got people who are saying, no, we can't afford it, Joe. We're broke. We don't have the money.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema is that, I recognize I've never been in the U.S. Senate. I don't think that they've ever been business people. And they're pontificating that these bills would be bad for the economy is such a circus of bad analysis. These bills would be booms for the economy. The economy does better when people have jobs, disposable income to spend, and transportation that can lubricate business formation. These two bills would create the economic boom that we've been looking for 30 years. And Manchin and Sinema, they have no idea what they're talking about on these economic and business questions. It's so painful for me as a business person to hear them opine on how these bills would or would not affect the economy because they're completely ignorant and wrong. And this is across the board a problem that we have in a lot of economic policy in this country is that we listen to people who don't have any experience in running a business. The best thing you need to do to create business formation and a strong economy is you need to put money in the pockets of people who spend. For 40 years, we've put money in the pockets of people who don't need to buy anything. And everyone who needs to buy things haven't had any money. And that's why we've had sluggish economy. It's very straightforward.
Yep.
We have a consumer economy, consumers don't have money. These two bills put more money in the pockets of people who need to buy things.
No, it makes perfect sense to me. Why don't our elected leaders get it?
I think there's something that happens when you go through the doors of the United States Senate where you have to check your logic at the door.
Do you have any faith in the hope that we might get one of these two bills or both of them? I have friends who keep saying, we're getting them both. You got to be optimistic. I guess I'm a natural pessimist in this, that I fear we get neither. I'm curious how you see it.
I'm pessimistic as well. To be optimistic requires some faith in Senators Manchin and Sinema to do the right thing. I have none in them.
And now you got Tester who's jumped in the middle of this saying that, whatever we do has to be paid for. And it is, from what I understand, the tax bill that the House Democrats have moved forward, they've figured out how they're going to pay it. They're going to raise taxes on corporations a little bit. They're going to raise the top marginal rate a touch. They're going to go after the people who are cheating on the IRS. There's a way forward to pay for all of it. But you've got someone like Manchin and others who are saying, no, we can't do that either.
The reason they don't want to do it doesn't have anything to do with economic logic. The truth is we know why they oppose it. Stuff. It's because their campaign donors are represented primarily by the Chamber of Commerce and the Restaurant Association and all these other big money interests that don't want to see people have more money in their pockets, working people do better. They don't want to see infrastructure. They don't want to see the playing field leveled in negotiation. They don't want to see more unionization. And these are the people who give and finance Manchin and Sinema and Tester's campaigns.
It's all about the money, then. That's it.
It's all about the money.
That's frustrating. And the sad reality is we've been put into this situation where, politics is a team sport at this point. Everyone's divided up into their teams, and we're given these binary choices of one or the other, and nothing seems to ever get done, and that plays right into the hands of the people who are in control, because that's how they want it.
But Rick, actually, let me, if I may, suggest an edit to what you just said. Things do get done. They just happen to be things that advantage rich people, because both teams are owned by monopolies and oligarchs. And so both teams present just a little bit of a different twist on what's in the interest of rich interests, of rich people and big corporations.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. So you figure if something's going to help rich people, it'll make its way through Congress. If it's going to help working people, forget it.
So how do we change that, Joe? I mean, you know, you're a rich guy. You've won the game so far. How do working people change that?
We have to vote, organize, agitate, and raise our expectations. I actually think, though, that we're at the beginning of a rebalancing here. It's hard to see historic forces unfolding when you're in the midst of them.
Right.
But if you step back a few steps, there is a rebalancing that I think is in its early stages back to worker power. And you're right, I've been super fortunate, I'm super privileged, and I'm going to try and use that privilege to make it easier for working people to get ahead. I don't want to live in a country where 8 out of 10 people live paycheck to paycheck. It's not worth having any money if you live in a society like that. You can't take it with you when you die. And so everything I want to do in the life I have, try and level the playing field for working people.
And to your point, we're seeing lots of strike activity going on.
Yeah.
Lots of strike votes happening. I mean, right now you've got national strikes at Nabisco. There's one to talk about John Deere. Carpenters in Washington State, there's talk of them going on strike. I mean, we're seeing a lot of activity and a lot of organizing. So you're right.
And the Biden administration is doing things that the Obama and Clinton administration didn't do. I don't think they're doing enough, but it would be untrue to not acknowledge that the Biden administration is more worker-friendly than any recent Democratic administration. You know, what they're doing on federal minimum wage for worker, for federal workforce, what they're doing on non-competes to try and rebalance power back to workers. There are a number of things where the Biden presidency has been the most pro-worker, pro-labor administration that we've had probably since I suppose Johnson.
Yeah, there's no question in my mind that in my lifetime he's been the most pro-worker, and that happened on day one when they fired Peter Robb. For me, that was a huge message. It was the shot heard, I hope heard around the boardroom, much like the shot that Peter Robb was a part of when they fired the Patco workers during the Reagan years, that he was instrumental in. So for me, the messaging out of that, I think, is important. And the fact that he was willing to, in the time of the Amazon organizing, to come out and say, look, you should have the right to join and form unions. I think that's a huge thing coming from someone with the bully pulpit that he has. I wish we would do more of it, but I give him credit for it.
Well, and I think the next Democratic president we have will be even more pro-worker. I think Biden represents an important shift back towards Democratic presidents being on the side of the worker. I think he's also said compelling things, for example, at a town hall when he was confronted by a small business person who said that, the business was having trouble hiring workers. And the president said, so raise your wages. If you're having trouble hiring workers, raise your wages.
Yep. Isn't that what we were taught in Econ 101?
I mean, Rick, you know, supply demand only... is only the argument of the day when it works for business owners. When it works for workers, then, you know, forget it. I mean, it's like they pick their argument.
Yeah, yeah. No, they've got their X's in different places. You're absolutely right. But before I let you go, I want to go back to the recall real quick. Just to reiterate, you think it's going to go all right? You think Newsom's safe? You think they're going to put down the recall? Is that where I'm getting?
Yeah, I don't think it's actually going to be close. I think it's going to be... I think it's more likely than not going to be a double-digit defeat for the recall.
Well, good. So if it is a double-digit defeat, does Trump and Elder and the rest of them claim it was rigged?
Oh, absolutely. No matter what happens, they're going to claim it's rigged.
Yeah, that's what I'm expecting, and that's the only prediction that I can make and be 99.99% positive of. that they're going to whine about something and that they're going to claim fraud and all kinds of stuff so that they can gin up more anger and activity in the base so that they can fleece them for a little bit more money. Just my thoughts. But, Joe, I appreciate the time. It's always good talking with you.
Same to you. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Joe Sandberg. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day Rhode Island Governor Theodore Green demanded that federal troops be sent to crush a textile strike in his state. The general textile strike, then in its second week, stretched across the Piedmont from New England to Georgia. Green declared, quote, "We are face to face, not with a textile strike, but with a communist uprising." His demands came after days of pitched battles between thousands of strikers and the Rhode Island National Guard in Salesville and Woonsocket. Secretary of War George Dern assured the governor and the press that 3,000 combat troops were ready and available for immediate duty in Rhode Island. President Franklin Roosevelt declined to send in federal troops, but the state assembly authorized the governor to close the mills and appropriated $100,000 in funds to beef up state police forces. The governor then directed Rhode Island's police chiefs to round up all communists on charges of inciting riots in textile centers across the state. It gave local authorities the pretext to round up and arrest over 200 alleged agitators, strike leaders, militants, and radicals. Over the course of 4 days, 3 strikers had been killed, including Charles Gorsinski at Salesville and Jude Cordomenci at Woonsocket. Hundreds had been seriously injured in the two cities. 7 of the 16 strikers who had been shot by state troops were near death. State National Guardsmen had been given the shoot-to-kill order to protect the mills and the scabs. Once the governor shut down the mills, police forces easily arrested dozens of flying squadron picketers and established martial law-like conditions, though it was never officially established. Within days, the strike would be quelled in Rhode Island.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, elections have consequences. You know, as we've been talking about, this is one of those things where you go, you know, who you put into office matters. And who you cast your ballot for puts us in these spots. And this is one of those moments where, you know, I was talking with my youngest daughter. You know, we're having this conversation about abortion rights and, you know, some of the things that are going on. And, you know, at the end of it, I said, you know, this is a matter of the largest percentage of people, in this country are the non-voting people. It's about making sure that you exercise your right to vote. If you're not happy with something, you work to change that. And, you know, especially for women in this moment, there's this kind of awakening that, you know, what was taken for granted, that they would have the ability to control their own bodies and control their own future, is now very much in peril because of our Supreme Court, who, like thieves in the night, allowed this Texas law to be, well, you know, put into place. Now, they're fighting it. There's going to be a process. You know, but if it gets back to the Supreme Court, I don't know that I have any faith in that court to undo it, which is why it was weird this past weekend that Amy Coney Barrett was at the 30th anniversary of the Mitch McConnell Center at the University of Louisville. Yes, 30 years there's been the McConnell Center. Here's someone who's, I don't think, has ever had a real job. He's been a senator for virtually ever, but somehow he's got the money to fund a center there and give scholarships to the University of Louisville. Anyway, she was given her little spiel, and came up right out and said, you know, my goal today is to convince you that this court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks. The fact that she would come out and say, no, we're not a bunch of partisan hacks, means you're a bunch of partisan hacks. That even you realize that everyone's calling you a bunch of partisan hacks. Because you are. And this, and look, understand, these people truly believe that, you know, they have their ideological philosophies. She said, you know, the justices have their judicial philosophies, not their political parties. And I go, bull. Most of these people were plucked out freshman year of college. Most of these people were identified by a system that is fabulously funded and visionary. The Federalist Society is a group that funds huge amounts of outreach to bring in their ideological wannabes. And they train them from day one on what their judicial philosophies are going to be. And they move them along in the process. And as long as they continue to check off the right boxes, have the right judicial philosophy, be the right kind of judicial activist, they move forward. They move up. Understand, Donald Trump didn't go searching for Amy Coney Barrett. He didn't go searching for Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch. He went to the Federalist Society, who said, here, these are the people that we've been grooming. These are the people that we've been molding into what we want the country to be, which first and foremost is a fascist state, a state where things are controlled by corporate America, a nice melding of corporate and government interests, which is why overwhelmingly the Roberts Court has sided with the Chamber of Commerce in like three quarters of the cases that they've put in briefs on. They are a corporate court. But now, as I said the other day, now people are finally going, wait a second, they actually did? The dog actually caught the abortion car? And the dog actually took a bite out of the car? Yes. Because once they always knew that once the dog caught the car, what was going to happen? There was no, oh, well, we've caught the car, we don't know what to do. They knew what to do. And this is only the beginning of this process. Roe is going to die the death of a thousand cuts. And then they're going to go after Griswold. And then they're going to go after all of the ability of women to chart their course. Because that's what the Federalist Society has been pushing. Along with their C Street buddies who've got this evangelical view of the country. Understand, in this country, religion and money are sacrosanct. And they're usually one and the same. So am I surprised that she would come out and say this? No, not at all. And they use every divisive tactic possible. This COVID was a godsend for them, because they literally have us fighting each other in the streets. We are, you know, the polling has us split down the middle. We've picked teams 50-50 on whether we should have vaccine proof or not, whether we should mandate people get vaccinated or not. This is the perfect world for the wealth class. They can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. This is that in real time. Scary and crazy stuff. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Nay is going to be here to share some thoughts. Back after this.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Climate change poses an existential threat to our lives, to our economy, and the threat is here. We can stop it from getting worse.
Biden pushes for infrastructure resilience following Ida's devastation. Toxic chemicals and sewage left swirling in hurricane's wake. Plus,
the last gallon of leaded gasoline was sold in Algeria in July.
A new milestone. The world finally got the lead out.
All of those milestones and mayhem straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I think we're at one of those inflection points where we either act or we're going to be in real, real trouble.
Oh, we're in trouble. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it's good to be back. Luckily, there were no big green stories over the past week, but I've got this today from the League of Conservation Voters, who have now told every Democrat in Congress that if they do not support federal climate action in Joe Biden's Build Back Better bill, their action fund will not endorse any of those Democrats.
Good. Putting their money where their mouth is.
Yes, ma'am. What did you got for us today?
Well, we are in peak hurricane season right now.
Great.
And Tropical Storm Mindy quickly formed on Wednesday and hit Florida's panhandle just hours later. Climate scientists have observed a trend toward faster intensification of storms due to warming oceans, and that gives communities no time to prepare. Mindy is the 13th named storm of the 2021 season. The average date for the 13th named storm used to be October 25th.
Wow. And really, this storm did just spin out of nowhere and boom, made landfall.
Yep. And in the wake of last week's Category 4 Hurricane Ida, as we go to air, the death toll has jumped to at least 82 across four states. If there is any good news from Ida, it is that New Orleans levees, pumps, and storm surge floodgates mostly held, but the state's electric grid did not. With Ida knocking down more transmission lines than Hurricane Katrina, Ike, Delta, and Zeta combined. The lights are finally back on in New Orleans, but areas outside the city are still without power. Ida's destruction forced the shutdown of 51 municipal drinking water systems, and more than 300,000 people are still without access to clean water.
Well, you know what wouldn't hurt? Burying those power lines. I understand there's a bill working its way through Congress which might be able to help pay for important stuff like that.
New reports are now emerging of extensive water and air pollution caused by Ida, which passed directly over one of the nation's primary oil and gas industry hubs in Louisiana. Before and after the storm, oil and gas facilities vented dangerous chemicals and gases into the atmosphere. The U.S. Coast Guard is now investigating nearly 2,000 reports of oil and chemical spills, including an 11-mile-long oil spill from an abandoned well. A recent GAO report found that the oil and gas industry has abandoned more than 18,000 miles of decommissioned pipelines in the Gulf of Mexico alone that continue to pose a pollution threat.
Wow. Create the problem and then abandon it.
President Joe Biden this week visited victims of Ida's destruction in Louisiana, Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, where the storm and its remnants unleashed historic rainfall and deadly flash floods that demolished infrastructure and caused billions of dollars in damages. On Tuesday, Biden unequivocally drew the connection between man-made climate change and this summer's extreme weather disasters that have affected nearly one in three Americans. He bluntly stated that U.S. infrastructure is clearly not ready for accelerating climate change impacts and urged Congress to pass his Build Back Better infrastructure jobs plan.
When I talk about building back better, I mean you can't build to what it was before this last storm. You got to build better so if the storm occurred again, there would be no damage. And so, folks, we got to listen to the scientists and the economists and the national security experts. They all tell us this is code red.
A new analysis this week by the Department of Energy finds that if Congress passes Biden's clean energy policies, doubling of U.S. solar energy projects could provide at least 40% of the nation's electricity by 2035 and employ as many as 1.5 million people, all without increasing electricity prices.
Or increasing emissions.
True. Congressional Democrats are now trying to hammer out the details of that massive budget reconciliation bill, including those crucial climate policies that the League of Conservation Voters has demanded in order to create millions of jobs, hardening the nation's infrastructure resilience. And finally, the world has finally stopped using toxic leaded gasoline, a century after it was developed and 50 years after its dangers were established. Leaded gasoline was phased out due to its high toxicity and links to lower IQs. IQs and higher rates of violent crime. The global phase-out of leaded fuel has prevented more than 1.5 million premature deaths and saved nearly $3 trillion per year from improved health and lower crime rates.
Yeah, but we still sold it until 2021. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Janice, during the break, sent me an email. Evidently, the story's already out that Larry Elder won't commit to accepting the results of the recall election. And no surprise. I mean, look, it doesn't take a genius, like I said just a couple minutes ago. 99.99999% sure that no matter what happens, they're going to complain that there was cheating, that the Democrats rigged the whole thing. It was Joe Biden. Joe Biden, while in the western part of the country, he rigged it himself. Just like during the pandemic when they claimed he was in his basement learning coding and how to hack into the machines. Crazy stuff. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, the recall and all the other stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So you find yourself in the state of Wisconsin. Why in Wisconsin?
Well, I do radio up here, and I do five or six stations, and they wanted me to come up here.
So, nice.
Yeah, I came up and going to do a little book signing and an on-air deal, and that's what I'm doing.
Outstanding.
And, eating some cheese.
You got to do that.
Right.
Maybe catch a Packers game.
That's it.
right now, a little questionable. What are your thoughts on the recall in California? How you see this going to play out?
Well, I think it has a couple of implications. One, in regard to, approach to COVID. I think that, people, because California has been a tougher state on COVID, I think that people in general, at least in that state, and some others for the most part, are not wanting, just a loose, well, we'll get over this type of attitude. So I think that's one implication. I don't think that the governor's approach to COVID, obviously, I don't think it took him out. And also, I think on a national level, this would have, I think, some implications. Heading into the midterm elections, it could have some idea. I know it's California, and people will say, well, that's a different type of state. But I still think that so much effort was put in to recall him, and it wasn't successful. So I would say that that will be an indicator of how people may or may not run, quote, on the COVID issue.
Yeah, as someone earlier said that, Florida had, I think, 2,500 deaths last week, and California had 38. So a state, twice as big as Florida had just 38 people. And look, every life is a loss, a tragic loss, but
right.
The numbers aren't even close.
Right. And so I think some of the candidates will look at other candidates for other offices across the country. And on the Democratic side, we'll look, because I'm not sure on the Republican side they'll analyze this correctly, but the Democrat side, I think they'll look at how he handled it, how he ran, and maybe take some lessons from that.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately, Larry Elder is not someone I think, even in a regular election, the people of California would palate very well. I mean, he has come off as really extreme.
Right. Also, it was just such a weird thing how a recall is tied to another candidate, I thought.
Yeah, it is bizarre. But look, Elder put himself in that position.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think that I think some of the numbers, if you break this down, and it means COVID is the most important issue facing multiple states across our country. And so I think some of the numbers might have national trends to them. And this will, You know, there were a lot of people, Rick, that thought this is it. Newsom's gone. He didn't handle this. He was repressive, and it went another direction. So,
well, we'll see. I mean, I'm guardedly optimistic that he's not going to be recalled. Some other folks that I've talked to are guardedly optimistic, but you never know until the votes are actually until they're actually counted.
I know. I'm talking as if the vote counts in, but you know, I'm just speculating where it's going to end up.
Yeah. No. Look, at the end of the day, it's California. I think you know they made it about Elder, so I think that's going to generate a lot of people to vote against Elder, not necessarily for Newsom, and to maintain this policy, but. Because you don't want really bad, you don't want to end up like Florida.
Well, and I think it raises a good point. You know, when I would look at elections and when I was in Congress, Rick, people would say, oh, that, you know, that political figure, you know, barely won. Well, you have to look at also who runs against them, how much money was spent, how they all campaigned. There's a lot of aspects to this thing. And I think in politics, too, sometimes we can get trends, but I think people tend to generalize some issues, you know, a bit too much.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out why they're recalling him and where the money came from to push this, because this really was, I think, a bit extreme.
I mean, do you think was some of the original stimulus that dinner?
That's part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of it is that sense that, you know, you're making rules that the rest of us have to follow that you don't, and there's some of that. But the money that pushed this, I believe, was all about weakening the bigger picture of weakening the state and on the national level, the potential of being able to flip the Senate on the short term in the event that something happens to Feinstein.
Well, that's true. It might have been a test run for, you know, some of the money out there and some of the interests, you know, that are out there. And then there's a certain amount of people that will complain and be disgruntled, period. You know, in our state of Ohio, a lot of people have said to me, you know, DeWine's done. He's finished. He's over with. Not necessarily. You talk to a couple of people, they like how he's handled it. You talk to one or two, and they don't like how he's handled it. But the question is, to what degree,
right,
number one, don't they like it? And number two, who's the alternative?
No, that's an excellent point. But, you know, we're in this weird moment now where we're divided up into teams. Either you believe that we should wear masks, or you vehemently know under no circumstances, whether you've gotten the vaccine or no, you're taking my religious freedom by making me be vaccinated. We're in these polar moments. And, you know, Joe Biden last week came out and said, look, we're going to mandate that people doing business with the federal government, your employees have to be vaccinated. You got the Surgeon General who has come out and has defended the administration. And look, I know some business leaders who are like, look, we got to get it done. We're going to move forward on it. How do you see this being part of this overall, this anger picture? Because I'll tell you, I've talked to some people who, you know, they're just beyond themselves.
Well, also, there are people that are angry. And I've also talked, it was very interesting today, earlier, to two anti-vaxxers who, I mean, were adamant. And, you know, it was a Trump thing versus the Biden thing, you know, in the red state versus the blue state. Now they're scared because they had a relative that got it, and another relative that got it, and a neighbor that got it. And these people, you know, are quite ill, and so now they're scared. I'm not saying they're to the point they're going to get the vaccination, but they're scared. And they didn't complain as much about today as they had in the past about some of the steps that President Biden took.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a darned if you do, darned if you don't on this. But and I know there's a mixed bag. There were some hospital employees in New York, and they quit. And so they're not delivering babies, and they're trying to find other people. And I understand there'll be cases like that where that will happen. Doesn't mean the whole country's going to do that. But I think that, you know, the president is utilizing as much as he can the ability where if you're a federal employee, then you're going to be under a different mandate in a sense than if you're a private sector employee. But it's still in the hands of the private sector if you're a company of over 100 or more. You know, of how you're going to handle it. And then there's still a question I think arises, Rick, you know, what about an employee where the company doesn't respond and the employee catches COVID? Do they have a right to sue?
I've been saying that from the beginning. Ultimately,
I question it.
Ultimately, it should be a workers' comp issue. If you got sick on the job, you should be able to claim that illness. And I've said from the beginning, capitalism will figure this out. Right. You know, we're gonna sue. We're going to hold people liable, and at some point, people to protect themselves financially more than health wise, they're gonna have to mandate things get done. And look, we're in a position where you have a choice, and I'm not advocating holding people down and jabbing them with the shot. I would never advocate for that, but there are consequences. You have the right to not get it, but the consequence in this moment is, well, you can't get a federal contract.
Right.
Seems simple to me.
Well, and I've always used this example. If you want to work at a YMCA camp and you're one of the counselors, guess what? You have to have certain shots or you don't work there.
Right.
It's not COVID. It's, you know, other type of shots, tuberculosis, et cetera.
Isn't this what Chris Wallace went through over the weekend? I forget who he was talking to, but went through the list of vaccines that kids have to get before they go to school. And there's a long list of them. Look, my wife's got a whole, you know, whole chart of all the vaccines our kids have gotten over the years just to be able to go to school. And, you know, I guess the only way you could get out of it is figure out how to claim your religion precludes you from getting a vaccine, which I think there are only a handful of those. And they're not the mainstream ones. But, you know, for the most part, most people, they were vaccinated and probably didn't even know it.
Right. And also, I think I'm pretty correct in saying due to the ruling when the vaccines came out through the commission, I think that if you claim it on a religious basis, you can't get it and you're fired, you cannot sue for discrimination.
No,
I think that's the current rule.
No, and look, the religious exemption thing. There's also an employer hardship clause in this, where they say if you're causing a hardship on the employer, they can let you go. That's the consequence. And as you've said, you can't go then and sue because you used your ace in the hole, and you played it and you lost.
Right.
Right. Seems simple.
And I like your line though. Capitalism will work it out. It will work through the system.
Ultimately, that's what's going to happen, because through our government, our ability to self-govern, we are not capable of taking care of things like this. In a democratic process, we're not. So something has got to take over. And look, the moneyed interests, they're going to protect themselves. Biden put these fines in place, there's no question employers are going to go, look, it's out of my hands. Either you get vaccinated or I got to find somebody to replace you. Because we're not going to lose the federal contracts over some whatever your twisted, misinformed mindset has gotten us. Just my view. Let's move on. Joe Manchin was all over the TV on Sunday. All over the place, saying that he's not going to vote for the $3.5 trillion spending bill. Not going to do it.
Well, a couple of things are happening. You know, Bernie Sanders said, "Well, look, we compromised from 6 million down to 3.5 trillion. I mean, from 6 trillion to 3.5 trillion." And frankly, Joe Manchin doesn't care. He doesn't care if he went from, you know, 12 million to 2.5 million. He's put a figure out there. You know how politics are. Once you jumped off the diving board, it's hard to get back on,
yep.
Right? And especially if the swimming pool's empty, you're going to hit. And Manchin has said, well, he did go from 1 trillion to 1.5 trillion. And then look, maybe Manchin will go up to 2 trillion. But the fact remains, I think, at some point in time, they are going to have to sit down, they, the powers to be, on the Democratic side, and decide what is the figure, because they're going to plug all of these items into the committee into a money figure based off $3.5 trillion. Now, if it's, you know, if they can't get a Republican vote, and it's, and he's going to hold to this, it's not going to be $3.5 trillion, but they've got to decide that number so they don't have to retool the entire, you know, process. I think the other dangerous thing, and don't get me wrong, you know, people stand up for their districts and their states. I fully understand that. If you've got a wedge, you know, if you can go to the speaker and wink and nod and say, hey, I got a little wedge here for my district I need. Yeah, I understand that. But I think with Senator Warner coming out, and it's very interesting, his approach, saying, well, he wants money for housing. Senator Warner knows they're going to not be probably at $3.5 trillion. So now he's saying, well, wait a minute, I want, you know, more money for housing. And the problem there is if other senators start to come forward and say, well, I want more money for this. Again, once they know the figure, if I were they, I wouldn't view that as a loss. Do they want the $3.5 trillion? Yes. Bernie would like to have had more. But if they can't get to a certain figure because of their circumstance, get, you know, what they can get is in the sense of having the policy intact.
Right.
That, no. These are policy changes, too, not just money.
No, I mean, ultimately, though, you got to get something.
That's what I'm saying about the dollar figure. They cannot afford to lose the $1.2 trillion infrastructure and lose the human infrastructure bill. They can't afford to do that. So they're going to have to come to terms with it. But Manchin was, you know, insistent. I don't know how he backs off of that now.
I don't think he can.
I don't think it'll happen.
You know, look, if I'm him, I know I've got leverage. I'm trying to get as much as I possibly can to bring back to the state to make myself look good. I mean, maybe I'm just not getting what the play here is.
Well, I'm with you because something has went haywire. And the reason I say that, I understand, you know, everybody likes fresh air and out in the open. But let's face it, with politics, you know, sometimes it's good to talk with the door closed when it comes to leaders and people that are in key positions of what they really want. That way people don't get, you know, crosshairs. And this is one example where this is being decided on Sunday news shows. And I don't know why it wasn't done where they sat down in a room and said, what is this figure we're all going to get to?
Right.
You know, what went wrong that it's spilled out, all out over the tables? And again, I'm all for fresh air and amendment processes, but when it comes to something this big, I would have assumed there would have been some private discussions of where they all wanted to be. Then they could argue their points, but they would know where they were all at.
Because I'm looking at this moment going, you know, why is Manchin on the Sunday shows when we should be talking about what's going on in Texas, when the Sunday shows should be talking about the decisions by DeSantis in Florida, while we should be talking about how insane the recall vote is going to be. And no, we're talking about one of the main Democratic priorities, getting infrastructure passed, rebuilding our roads and bridges, making sure Granny gets some new chompers and hearing aids, that kind of stuff. And we're stuck on talking about, no, Joe Manchin's throwing a tantrum.
Right, and stuck talking about, you know, one vote short. I mean, that's the conversation. What's one vote short? We know that. So that's why it's got to go to a different level of discussion. And if they can come out with some agreement where, you know, they get to a dollar figure, because, again, he's went from $1 trillion to maybe $1.5 trillion. So maybe it goes up a bit after that. But they can't decide it on Sunday shows.
Nope, not at all.
No.
But we'll see where it goes. And you know where I'm at. I fear we get nothing because, you know, the circular firing squad takes over and everyone shoots each other, but we'll see. But Bob, I appreciate the time. Enjoy
you,
Wisconsin.
Rick.
I love Wisconsin. And good luck, man.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks so much. Our good friend, Bob Ney. Like to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. I'll take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that the state police stormed Attica Correctional Facility in New York. 4 days earlier, the inmates had taken over the prison. One guard was killed. The guards were members of AFSCME Council 82. The prisoners demanded improvements to their brutal living conditions in the overcrowded prison. Police retook most of the prison, but the inmates held guards hostage in cell block D. One of the prisoners, Elliot James Barkley, explained the takeover. "We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not depend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disrespect for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States." When the police stormed the prison, they dropped tear gas from helicopters. They fired 3,000 rounds, firing on prisoners and hostages indiscriminately. They killed 29 inmates and 10 hostages.
Police claimed the prisoners had killed the hostages. They also accused the inmates of committing atrocities against the guards. Public outrage swelled against the inmates, including racially charged hate directed at the black prisoners. But autopsies proved that all of those killed had been felled by police bullets. Attica became the rallying cry for those concerned about prison conditions. It has been referenced by many in movies and songs, including John Lennon's Attica State. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the MyPillow guy had another rally. They set up for 10,000. 10,000 people going to show up to the MyPillow rally. Evidently, they were going to have speakers like Mike Lindell himself, because he needs the attention. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was going to be there. Pastor Greg Locke, a bunch of people were going to be there to rile the crowd ahead of September 18th because Insurrection 2.0 is coming. Evidently, the 10,000 people that they expected was a crowd of, you know, like 250. So, you know, they got this giant setup, you know, speakers, the whole nine yards, and a handful of people showed up. But what's interesting is these are the most faithful. These are the most ardent. And some of the pictures from the rallies was quite funny. A lot of, you know, blank Biden. A lot of, you know, Trump won, but they stole it from us. My favorite, and a listener sent me this image. Trump won, !! Biden is a cheater. Bye, Dan. He's a cheater. It's Biden. It's with an E, not an A, just to get that right. Now, these are the folks who say, you know, part of the identity of the Republican Party now is you have to believe that Trump won the election and that Bye, Dan is a cheater. In fact, the most recent CNN SSR poll points out that 59% of Republicans say that you have to believe that the election was stolen to be a good Republican. That is frightening. Absolutely frightening. I got to wonder, you know, how many are supposed to say that that COVID's a hoax? Or that they want to take ivermectin? Scary times, my friends. Scary, scary times. And finally, evidently, Veronica Walski, who is a big QAnon fan. Evidently, her attorney, Lynn Wood, did a little video talking about, I'm going to sue the hospital if they don't give her ivermectin. There's a video of her walking into Staples wearing a Lone Ranger mask, saying, see, I've got a mask on, and saying that she's got a medical exemption with great conviction and privilege. She is now dead. And as someone pointed out, well, she died wearing a mask. If only she had worn one to protect her from getting the COVID, maybe she wouldn't have had to wear the one that they used to try and save her life. Sad stuff. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Make sure you follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow. Give us a like over at Facebook. YouTube, subscribe, share, all that stuff. Lots of ways to participate. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.